Hi there. I can tell that you're just about to listen to a podcast from RN, which is fantastic, but I would love to encourage you to download my program. I'm Fenella Kernebone. I host By Design. It's a show all about design and architecture and how we live in this world. You can find all the information and download the podcast as well from RN's website.
G'day, Cameron Wilson joining you. Welcome to Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. To the East Kimberley shortly, where there's a significant handover of some artwork tonight. The Gidja people are known around the world for their sought-after paintings, but a couple of years back, hundreds of these paintings were badly damaged in a flood. Restoration experts have been working ever since to repair them, and tonight, at the Warman Art Centre, these valuable pieces will be returned. We'll bring you that whole story very soon. Also today, the unusual sights you come across on an ostrich farm.
And of course, the male bird that you're looking at there, that's of course the male bird's a blackbird that wears lipstick, and he's sort of done his mating display towards you. So that says he's either fearful of you or he fancies you.
We'll reveal exactly what that ostrich is thinking a little later on Bush Telegraph. Well, it's a five-year plan, but it's unlike China's long-term plans. This one is part of the US government's protection for its farmers. The 2030 Farm Bill covers a range of measures, from support for farmers to food stamps for low-income earners and even overseas aid programs. It's causing something of a political stoush at the moment in Washington as the US continues to negotiate a series of free trade deals. It might actually seem odd that measures which some see as protecting US farmers from the rigours of the global market are actually being openly pursued and debated. Joining me now to discuss this is Tony Maher from the National Farmers Federation. Tony is the General Manager of Policy for the NFF. G'day, Tony.
Morning, Cameron.
And also in Melbourne is Andrew Hudson, trade lawyer and partner with Hunt & Hunt. Andrew, nice to have you back on the program. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Cameron. Nice to be back.
Andrew, I'll start with you. The Farm Bill, simply, what is it?
Well, in some respects, it's more than just a farm bill. It's what they call the Agriculture Reform, Food and Jobs Act. And every 5 years, as you mentioned before, they have to pass an act, and it covers a variety of things. Importantly, this is the real big political issue, it covers food stamps, but it also covers the way in which the US government looks after its agricultural sector in terms of subsidies, in terms of insurance payments or helping with insurance payments to farmers. It helps things like foreign aid. It also deals with things like bio industries and the like. So it covers a variety of things. This bill has passed the Senate. It's only passed the Senate at this stage. It should have been passed last September, but the US went into a bit of a policy lockdown. So there's been an extension. Should get passed by this September. Passed by the Senate. Still got to go to the House of Representatives. And I think the House of Representatives are keener on putting in more cuts in terms of the food stamps part.
Okay, so the political debate is going on at the moment. Isn't that unusual in its own right? This thing normally sails through.
Well, it's ultimately these things, like much legislation, are political in nature. And money for the agricultural sector and looking after American farmers and Americans' interests here and overseas through foreign aid, it's generally a good news story and everyone's keen on it. So this is one of the bigger debates they've had. And anything, I guess, from an American perspective, an American agricultural perspective, that would lead towards a reduction in payments to people who would otherwise get them does open up the debate, and particularly the debate about people who get food stamps. There's the ever-increasing, middle-class hungry group, and they're going to be disadvantaged by this.
Okay, so this is one of the reasons that it's politically difficult in the US at the moment. This food stamp program has blown out because the economy struggled.
Correct.
Which means it's a more expensive program.
Correct.
Now.
And the Senate bill reduces the allowance for food stamps by $4 billion. But the House of Representatives bill, which is a separate bill which is floating around, is talking about reducing cover by $20 billion. So they're showing that we're financially, fiscally responsible, and we're cutting programs to people like lottery winners, for example.
It gets confusing very quickly, doesn't it? Because this bill actually links subsidies payments to farmers and feeding the poorest people in the US and conservation programs as well, all under one umbrella.
Yeah, and that's why they call it this omnibus bill to cover a variety of things. And it does. And people think about it in terms of one thing or another, but they can easily lose the other. So there are some changes to policies, but a lot of it is still about looking after the local population and the local agriculture.
Tony Maher, why does this matter to Australian farmers? What's going on in Washington at the moment?
Well, what it means, Cameron, is a continuation of the uneven playing field. I suppose that term gets bandied around a little bit, but really what we're talking about is payments to farmers that really mask and disguise market signals. These sorts of payments where farmers are getting subsidies and assistance to underwrite their business is really foreign to Australian farmers, and what it does is distort sort of the markets and the signals, as I say, for global competition.
So when you hear Australian farmers unhappy that they're competing against producers around the world that get a higher level of help from their governments, that get subsidies, in the American case, in the US case, it's this bill here that is actually lays out the types of payments that the American farmers are getting.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, it's not new. We've been aware of this for some time, and the farm bill has been around for some time. And there's some similar payments, I suppose, in the EU with the Common Agricultural Policy. So Australian farmers are used to this sort of thing, and I suppose we continue to try and compete and try and advocate for reductions in these sorts of policies. And we've got to continue trying to work hard and producing, high quality, safe food that we can export to global markets.
The Australian farmers might be used to it, but not necessarily happy with it.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, we'll advocate, NFF has for some time, and we will continue to advocate in the right forums, as I say, to reduce or remove some of these subsidies to even up the playing field. The fact of the matter is that I think, as Andrew's discussed, it's as much about social, or a lot of social issues included in the policy, and similar payments in the EU aren't necessarily going anywhere soon because of that fact that it is social and it is political issue.
Tony, which Australian industries or sectors do you think are most affected by the US Farm Bill?
Well, the Farm Bill covers a range of sectors, from grains to less so horticulture, but it's really across the board. I mean, we're talking about rice and other commodities, so it's pretty comprehensive and it goes right across the board. And it depends, I suppose, on what sort of payments we're looking at. I mean, some of the things are crop protection schemes, which again provide that risk or remove that risk from the farmer's normal business operations, and goes to other things like R&D and some of those other payments that, environmental measures, these sorts of things that just, again, assist farmers with the normal day-to-day business.
But is it Australian farmers that want to sell their product into the US market that are most affected, or is it much broader than that? Does it affect pretty much the market and the trade in food products right around the world?
Look, these days, the market for agricultural commodities is international, and what we're seeing is, global prices impacting on Australian prices or vice versa. It really is a global market for agricultural products these days. The supply chains are that advanced that we can move product around the world at the drop of a hat. So it not only affects Australian farmers' prices, but it affects global prices significantly.
Tony Mars, the General Manager of Policy at the National Farmers Federation, speaking just there. Also with me is Andrew Hudson, a trade lawyer and a partner with Hunt & Hunt Lawyers. We're discussing the US Farm Bill, which is in the process of, it's been through the Senate. It's now to be debated in the House of Reps in Washington at the moment. We're discussing how it affects Australian producers. Andrew, do you agree with Tony about its implication for Australia?
Oh, look, it does. I mean, the reality is it's got an implication for Australia, but the rest of the world. And as Tony points out, the EU has not dissimilar payments. I think the US is being made a little bit more accountable about the nature of its subsidies and its programs. The Brazilian government has had some success with the WTO about US support for the cotton industry. And in Australia, we actually have anti-dumping and countervailing duties imposed on exports of US biodiesel associated with some federal government programs in the US, and also some Missouri state programs. And that, obviously has one way of leavening stuff out. But Tony's absolutely right. It's a global issue, and you're looking at global resolutions to try and improve the free market for goods and services. One of those things is WTO, and that's struggling along and limping along significantly. So one of the improvements in market access and treatments will be looking at FTAs and the like, and obviously Tony will be working with his group very carefully on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, to which Australia and US will be a party, and if that gets through, hopefully the US will be giving some significant additional market access reforms over and above the US Free Trade Agreement.
Tony mentioned there the focus on crop protection or crop insurance, as some people might call it. It seems that one of the characteristics of this bill is a move away from direct payments and towards crop insurance in the US. Does that mean a lessening of the support for farmers? Is it as simple as that?
In theory, it does. A lot of theories are very good theories, but the reality is that they're supposed to remove direct payments to farmers. It's supposed to remove direct payments to farmers who aren't actually farming.
So this is a cash payment to farmers they get whether they put a crop in the ground or
not. Correct. And the work is on reforming that. And a lot of US government, Congress members actually have farms which do benefit from this. And a lot of the foreign aid which gets sold is linked to US production. So hopefully they'll do better at it.
I was just reading in The Economist that John Bon Jovi and Bruce Springsteen own farms, so in theory get payments from the US taxpayer.
Correct. There is no means test associated with the benefits that go in. But they are moving towards increasing, I think they pay about, federal government in the US pays about 62% of insurance premiums against things like drops in markets. And they also provide, of course, disaster relief.
Tony Marr, in Australia, we have this debate that crop insurance, some kind of public-assisted crop insurance scheme would be a decent idea here as well, don't we?
Oh, look, we do, and we've been working with the government on drought policy that has looked at these sorts of things, and there was a report released recently that looked at a pilot program in WA, crop insurance program, and essentially it came out that these are very expensive programs, and that sort of again leads us to the point where you've got the US government subsidising up to 2/3 of the cost of these insurance programs for US farmers.
But isn't it hard to run the argument that how dare you do this in the US when we looked at it ourselves here but just decided we couldn't afford it?
Yeah, well, I suppose it comes down to some of the things we touched on earlier, is that some of the political sensitivities around the US and some of the social issues that underpin this policy.
Tony, correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding of this crop insurance scheme that's being debated at the moment is if a crop fails, a farming family, each the husband and the wife, can get a payment of about $50,000 each?
Look, it's pretty lucrative, Cameron. It'd be a really nice policy to have here in Australia, as you say, and we've been talking to governments about some of these measures. We're hopeful, but realistic as well. They are very lucrative.
Are you better off as a farmer if your crop dies in the US?
Well, we talked about before, I mean, some farmers are getting payments for not doing anything at all, and that's the same in the EU. You get payments for it's particular circumstances, of course, but, some people are getting payments for doing nothing at all, and that's just, it's staggering to Australian farmers who are out there working and doing the right thing and trying to compete on the global market, busting their gut each day and those sorts of things, and not getting anything like the assistance. And it's not to say that we want payments for doing nothing, but when you're competing against some farmers that are, then it makes it difficult.
Andrew, what Tony describes there as doing nothing, others would characterise as managing the land, stewardship payments. Is that
in part, yes. Yeah. It's sort of like it's almost natural selection, saying that your crops aren't working, but we don't want. And it's a bit of, they will see it as part of strategic resource management. We want the crops there just in case, or we think it's worthy. I mean, part of this farm bill includes additional assistance for war veterans to set up agricultural processes and the like. I think on top of what Tony said is that the Australian government would be very cautious about adopting any sort of insurance premiums or subsidies, because we like to be seen as a fair trader in the world, and anything we do in that perspective runs into risks of running into anti-subsidy programs.
But do you feel that there's maybe some of the public discussion in Australia around this is changing at the moment? We've got the SPC situation that we discussed in the past. We've heard calls for an aid program to buy up cattle in Queensland and feed the poor in Indonesia. We've also heard various ideas about tinning beef for the pensioners in Australia and all the rest. It seems like the attitude's shifting a little bit at the moment.
And I certainly think it is. One of the big issues, for example, under the proposed Japanese free trade agreement is what they call the car for cows argument, where the Japanese want additional access for their cars in here at a lower duty, and we want additional market access for our meat going into Japan. So I think there is an empathy towards that, and there's a recognition that we do need the industry. It does need to be appropriately remunerated and protected and looked after.
Tony, finally to you. What do you feel? Do you feel there's a sense at the moment that perhaps Australian agriculture will move a little more down the US path and there's a push for more protection for farmers here?
Look, I think for some time there's been a need to make sure that Australian farmers have the capacity to compete on the global market. I think we have to be pretty careful and think about what sort of policies that means and look at what's being done around the world. But certainly what we've been calling for some time is to reprioritise agriculture and really recognise that, you know, the part it plays in Australian life and Australian culture and make sure that it's, you know, it's at the forefront of government's mind when these sorts of issues come up. So whether it's drought or whether it's some sort of policies that allow farmers to compete, allow them to invest and allow them to be innovative so they can continue to, you know, be suppliers of high quality, safe food to global markets. Mm.
Well, it's interesting to hear what's happening in the US at the moment and how it affects Australian farmers. Tony, thank you for chatting with us today.
Thanks, Cameron.
Tony Mark, General Manager of Policy at the National Farmers Federation. And Andrew, as always, thank you for explaining what can be fairly complex stuff in simple terms.
Thanks, Cameron. Nice to be back.
Andrew Hudson is a trade lawyer and a partner with Hunt and Hunt Lawyers. Coming up next on Bush Telegraph, Rural News. You'll be hearing from a familiar voice very soon. Michael McKenzie, who now presents First Bite on the weekend on RN, has been out looking at an ostrich farm, and he's going to tell us all about it very soon, so stay with us for that. First, though, Tony Allen's been following the rural news today. Tony, you just keep bringing in stories about filming pigs at the moment. What's the latest?
You could almost make a living filming pigs at the moment. It's the biggest thing since Babe. Australian Pork Limited is now going to do its own filming at piggeries near Young in New South Wales to counteract the illegal footage that surfaced on YouTube this week.
Mm-hmm.
As we've mentioned, two farms have had films secretly taken by animal activists, and yesterday a film of pigs in distress on Ian Pollard's farm obtained by Animal Liberation was released on social media. Well, the chief executive of Australian Pork Limited, Andrew Spencer, says the industry is looking at releasing some film next week to tell what it says is a more accurate story of how pigs are farmed.
We want to make sure that people understand what that piggery really looks like. So we've got a film crew out there getting some footage. Hopefully that'll be up probably next week, maybe on our website, to say, this is that farm that you saw on YouTube secretly videoed. This is what it really looks like.
So I guess the question is who will the public believe, the industry film or the activist film? Maybe yes. Neither. Maybe both. Who knows? Mm. All right. This is unusual. Why is Joe Hockey weighed into a debate about abattoirs in the north? He's not usually the voice you hear from on this.
Well, yeah, the shadow treasurers usually don't go too far from the treasury, but Joe Hockey addressed graziers last night at the annual Cloncurry Cattlemen's Dinner in northwest Queensland. That's right in the heart of Bobcat territory. Mm. And Mr. Hockey was asked, how will we save the northern cattle industry, which, as we know, is on its knees because of drought and low beef prices and cuts to live exports? And Mr. Hockey said, we need abattoirs in the north. He said meat processing plants would increase access to export markets.
I think it's also important that we look at perhaps a halal butchery located in the north, maybe two of them, that allow abattoirs to operate and have export industries of halal meat into new markets. They've got to be the right abattoirs in the right places. They've got to have the capacity to export to key markets.
So given that the polls are suggesting he will be the federal treasurer in not too distant a future, that's interesting comment.
That he has a strong view on abattoirs in the north. Hmm, interesting. Okay, finally today, earlier this week, there was a ban on seabed mining announced in the Northern Territory. What's your reaction been to that?
Well, it's a ban on seabed mining around Groote Eylandt in the Gulf Carpentaria, and that followed years of pressure from the local Indigenous community. But a mining company called Northern Manganese says it's prepared to take legal action. It is not at all happy about this mining ban because it's put a halt to a project that could be worth billions of dollars. The NT government has flagged the possibility of compensation for mining companies, but the chairman of Northern Manganese, Doug Dawes, says even compensation would be very costly.
We don't want compensation. We want to get on with the job. But if we've got to go down the path of compensation, it's difficult to comprehend just how much that would end up costing both our company and the Northern Territory government.
What's manganese used for, Tony?
Stainless steel, making stainless steel, and it's in batteries too, and lots of other electronics uses. Very useful mineral indeed.
Okay, on that note, I'll let you go. Have a good weekend, and see you next week. Tony Allen with the latest there in rural news. This is Bush Telegraph on RN.
It's not just how you arrange the objects, it's how the audience is open and attuned. I mean, I think people do enter exhibitions with a great level of subconscious desire.
Are you getting your heart's desire? Join me for a conversation on the kind of curating that's happening right now, what it means for the art on show and for you looking. Drawing from a wider world of art and culture, that's Weekend Arts with me, Sarah Kanoski, Saturday from 2 here on RN.
Speaking of a wider world of art and culture, we're off to the East Kimberley very soon, where there is a significant handback of some artwork tonight. This is artwork, that valuable artwork, both in financial terms and culturally, that was damaged a couple of years back in some bad floods, and it's been repaired by some experts, and it's being handed back to the local community tonight. We'll tell you all about that very soon. 20 years ago, ostrich farming was seen as the next get-rich-quick scheme, but when global prices plummeted for both leather and feathers, so did the industry's reputation. But that was then, and these days, supply can't keep up with demand for another part of the bird, its meat, and northern markets are prepared to pay big money for the tender flesh. So, why isn't ostrich sitting in local supermarkets right next to kangaroo? RN First Bite's Michael McKenzie travelled to one of Australia's few big ostrich growers to meet, then eat.
I've never driven into a farm where the livestock was taller than I was. Michael Hastings, thanks very much for letting me come and look at your ostriches.
Pleasure. You didn't say how tall you were, though.
Yeah, I know. I'm close to 6 foot in the old scale. And how tall are your ostriches here?
Our tallest would be getting close to 11 foot tall.
That's huge.
Particularly if you think that those birds are going to be ranging between around about 140 kilograms up to 180 kilograms. So that's a very big bird. But I'm just hoping you can sort of visualise that, you know, this is probably the closest thing you'll see to dinosaurs running around. Certainly when you appreciate that their knees reverse to ours, so their legs fold back. So when they're striding out, they're making big steps forward. And when you see a flock of 300 or 400 sort of running out across a paddock.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Hello. Hello. Pretty birdie.
So we're at the breeder farm at the moment. And, of course, the male bird that you're looking at there, that's, of course, the male bird's a blackbird that wears a lipstick. And he's sort of done his mating display towards you. So that says he's either fearful of you or he fancies you.
I don't really mind, but I do like the lippy. It's a beautiful colour. Just tell people how you got into this, because you were a beef farmer to begin with, weren't you?
Yes, well, I came from a background of beef farming, but the property wasn't viable. And in order for me to return to agriculture, I had to find a different farming technique that didn't require a huge amount of area in order to make the property profitable for me to return. So I was at university, came across ostrich, decided that that was potentially the ticket for me to be able to return back to the farm. And 25 years on, I'm back here with 3,500 ostrich.
Well, it's interesting you should say this, because I remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, when you were kicking off this business, ostrich farming was all the go. Everyone was saying this is the way forward, it's going to be a tax haven, we're going to be lots of money made. And then the global industry, as I understand it, in ostrich products just collapsed, didn't it?
The ostrich industry isn't new. The industry was founded, of course, in South Africa in the around about the 1860s, mm-hmm. and was very strong. And the South Africans had a monopoly on the world market and really nurtured it. And that really was fantastic for them. But in the early 90s, they deregulated. So the world market was used to around about 200,000 birds worth of product, and all of a sudden they were faced with 1 million birds going into the same markets that hadn't been expanded for many years.
So prices plummeted.
They did. But it was very good for the industry in the long term, because it expanded the products such as the leather and the meat to markets that never could get access to it.
And leather is renowned. I mean, the ostrich leather, the quality of it and the durability of it is now renowned as being some of the best in the world, and you're obviously capitalising on that locally with your shop that's selling ostrich leather products. But are you in it for that, or are you mostly in it for the meat?
Well, probably about 7 or 8 years ago, you would have said that leather was still probably our primary product, because a lot of our meat at that stage was heading to Europe. But we now export a lot of meat into Canada, the US and Japan. Over there it sells a health meat, because it's a red meat, low in cholesterol, high in iron, very, very tender. And if people were consuming it, they'd probably liken it more similar to beef, to anything else. And that market's just grown. We can't keep up with it. So now meat is actually our primary product. But leather is still, you know, is the Rolls Royce of all leathers and a very important component of our return. But the meat has just overtaken it. And look, literally, they're a walking feather duster as well. History of ostrich farming was all originates to the feather. That's why they were domesticated originally.
Who was using the feathers?
Well, the wing feathers have always been a lovely luxury item. Popped into ladies' hats in Europe back in the early 1900s as a prestige item. But all the feathers over the body, because they've got fine filaments, create static, which pick dust up. So they've always been the feather duster. So pretty well all the bird gets used.
Here we are in another part of your property as we've been walking and talking. And we've got different species of ostrich to the ones we've just seen back there.
Yeah, this chap up here we've got here, that's a Zimbabwe blue. Now, this guy tends to have a little bit of bad attitude. So in a moment, we'll just keep you back from the fence there.
Okay.
I don't want to check out whether you've got a pacemaker or not.
Whoa.
I'll just walk over the fence for a minute. And I'll show you really what he'll what he'd like to do.
Okay. Michael's raising his arm up as if it's a neck.
He's just being territorial. He's saying that this is his paddock, they're his hens, and he doesn't want us to remove them from him or compete with him.
And, you know, I think that's fair enough. I'm completely in agreement with him on that. So he was actually pressing his chest against the fence, which is a good metre and a half high, and pushing hard and opening his mouth in that territorial display.
Well, what he was doing is trying to get close enough in order to kick us. Now, of course, he's got two toes and one's got a very, very big nail on it. Now, if he's going to be aggressive, he's going to kick forward and down with around about 600 pounds per square inch. So we don't have to worry about the peck or the beak.
Right.
It's that kick. So he was pushing against the fence to say, well, if you come a bit closer, I'm going to give you one heck of a wallop. Normally, I shouldn't have told you that, because I could have got you to go out and get an egg in the middle of the paddock and I could have grabbed your camera and then everyone really would have had something to look at.
When it comes, therefore, to egg collecting, how perilous is your job?
What we do is we put a pile of sand where we want them to lay,
right.
And generally that attracts them to a site, so that's usually quite close to a gate. So if we were in the situation where we are at the moment and there was egg that was a little bit dicey, that's when I'd get a decoy such as yourself to walk along the fence and lead the bird away. And then I'd safely collect the egg.
Okay.
Or I'd have a long pole and just drag it out. In the bigger paddocks, that's less of an issue because you've got a lot of cockbirds and it's quite simple to drive around and pick up the eggs. They're very mild. They don't taste strong. It's just you've got to measure them by the cup rather than by the egg.
So you could feed an entire family about four times over with one egg?
Oh, definitely. So you can have your scrambled eggs, you can do your omelettes and your quiches and...
Just trying to break them open to start the beating is going to be hard enough. I can imagine you need a bit of a jackhammer or something, do you?
Oh, definitely a hammer. No, we do open them with a hammer.
I was joking and you weren't.
No, definitely. We open every egg with a hammer. And then we just pour the contents out. Ostrich farming, you know, hasn't been one for the faint-hearted, because you can't just all of a sudden run out of money and then take a few birds down to the corner market and cash a few in.
Most of Michael's ostrich heads to Europe, the US and Canada, where he can't keep up with demand.
That's precisely the point, and the prices we get overseas are still at a significant premium, and we're selling the whole lot in a hit. So I'm exporting, you know, anything from 8 to 12 tonne per container of our trim, our different steak cuts and our fillet at the same price as I'd be sending 10 kilos down to a restaurant. So the logistics at the moment, I'd love to do more domestic, and I need to, because the one thing that we do have to have a domestic market for is because there's such a massive push for free-range chooks, we're seeing disease outbreaks. So we're seeing more avian influenza and things like that, and that does cause problems for exporters such as myself. So in those situations, countries do close their markets down. Australia has very few outbreaks of any of these diseases. But if you do have one, generally you can face a restriction of 6 to 12 months. But there was an outbreak in the mid-90s in Tamworth, and we actually lost half of the ostrich industry because we were relying on one market in Europe, and the EU shut us down for 18 months. So we developed a plan. So we do regular testing on this farm so that we can actually maintain exports even if there was an outbreak in Australia.
Aside from the huge growth in meat exports from Michael's farm, along with the leather and the feathers, is genetic stock, because the market is really hungry for new populations of productive ostrich. And how do you send ostrich genes overseas?
Frequently the age we'd send them is day-old chicks, because for the first 3 or 4 days, the chicks live entirely on the yolk sac, which they've absorbed, which is the yolk of the egg. So the chick grows on the egg white, and then just before he hatches, he takes the whole yolk into his stomach, and that's his food supply, because the parents won't feed him. So he's got to learn to feed. So that's a perfect time for us to export chicks around the world, because they don't need food, feeding or watering at day one or day two. So we can fly them anywhere in the world without food and water. They come out of the crates and they're ready to get going.
So you've got a core breeding stock of how many?
The breeding flock is around about 450 breeding birds, which can produce anything from 8 to 15,000 eggs.
A year?
Yeah.
Wow.
You can probably hear that cockbird booming in the background.
Yeah, I can. I thought it was you.
Yeah, no, so he's actually blowing his whole neck up.
Before I let you go, though, I've got to ask you, how many other farms like this are operating at your level around Australia?
Unfortunately, there are very few at the moment. We're rebuilding the industry currently, because it did go through a lot of hiccups, and that was primarily due to unethical middlemen or marketers that weren't paying farmers. Our saviour, I suppose, was that we had a policy that as soon as a marketer didn't pay us, they got no more product. We ran out of marketers, and therefore I had to bite the bullet and export all our product ourselves. And that probably has been one of the key reasons why we're still here and we've succeeded.
You manage your own supply chain, essentially.
We do. There's still quite a few birds out there, but not many breeding commercially at the moment, and particularly on this scale.
So you foretell that there's actually enough room for more people like yourself to enter the industry for the first time, and that the meat prices will remain stable?
Oh, most definitely. Even more so, because South Africa, they've got endemic bird flu, which has made it very difficult for them to keep up their supplies to Europe. We could increase probably 10 or 15 fold and still not fulfil our current markets. So we're hoping that the next 2 or 3 years are going to be the years of the ostrich again.
Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Terrific. I hope you enjoy your meat shortly.
Yeah, I can't wait, actually. Let's get back to the car quickly.
You're hearing there from musician David Hewitt, who hails from South Africa, which happens to be the birthplace of the ostrich. You also heard the voices of ostrich farmer Michael Hastings and RN First Bites' Michael McKenzie. Michael, that's McKenzie, will tomorrow present more of this story on his own program, including tucking into a meal of ostrich served in one of only two restaurants that this farm supplies in Australia. So that's on RN First Bite tomorrow afternoon from 1 p.m, or if you prefer, you can download it right now from the website. This is Bush Telegraph. An emotional ceremony will take place tonight in the Kimberley when hundreds of culturally valuable artworks are handed back to the community at Warman. The ochre paintings are of the Gidja people, and they're some of the most sought after by collectors of contemporary Indigenous art. Hundreds of them were damaged when parts of the East Kimberley were badly flooded about 2 years ago, And that's where Michelle Scott came in, a conservator from Melbourne University. She stepped in to help repair these valuable works. In a moment, you'll hear more from Michelle Scott and also Gabrielle Nadia, the chair of the Warman Arts Centre. But first, local artist and Gidja woman, Rosaline Park, told me about the art and how it was damaged.
Well, at first, when the water came through my house, I didn't, you know, we losing all our stuff. And then when I seen crates and paintbrushes and paints going past my house, I just started to cry. I knew our gallery was already underwater then.
So you knew the paintings were lost?
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, we couldn't do anything. I tried to save my own stuff. And then when the water settled the next day, I went out with my four-wheeler and trailer and rescuing as much as painting as I could.
Where did you find them?
On hills, up trees, in riverbanks, in my backyard. Some just landed on my back veranda.
And how many are we talking?
Oh, don't know. Good enough.
Lots.
Can't really tell you, yeah.
So what, you spent quite a bit of time searching and retrieving the paintings?
Yeah, not only paintings, like everyone else's stuff too.
Why was it so sad for you?
Because this is our new gallery and it's the first time we had a flood big like that and no one expected it and everyone lost everything.
The
personal belongings and all. And plus all our paintings. Some we still never retrieved.
Why are the paintings so valuable to the local people?
Because it's the story of our dreaming and stories about other people's dreaming that's already gone, left us. Every painting is different. Everybody got a different story to their paintings.
What sort of state were the paintings in when you found them? What condition?
Oh, muddy, some with mould on them. Some were ripped. Yeah, we couldn't recognise majority of them.
What did you think would happen to them when you found them?
I just thought I'd just bring it back to the art centre and see if we can get them fixed.
Rosaline Park is one of the artists working at the Warman Arts Centre. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN. Gabrielle Nodia is the chair of the Warman Arts Centre. Gabrielle, when you saw these paintings being found and the condition they were in, how did you feel?
I feel very sad and lost. Like I didn't know at the time. Kind of put me out of mind, out of sight, you know.
How many of the Warman Arts Centre's paintings or how much of its collection was lost or damaged?
Well, just a few main ones got really damaged by the flood that the flood took down the river and never be replaced again. But 80% got damaged and went down to Melbourne. Sent to Melbourne and the rest, sort of like have been put away, but still like wasn't really damaged. But
so about 20% was safe, and the remaining 80% was either lost or damaged in the flood.
Yeah, yep, that's correct. Yeah.
How important is the art centre, the Warman Art Centre, to the local community? It's the Gidja community.
Gidja community, yeah, very very important. Like we see it is. Last line of defence in keeping our story strong and through our painting, and get connected to country really is through our painting, and yeah, all that sort of thing sort of come in behind it, like keeping culture and language strong and etc.
So
artwork.
So when you found out there was some the art centre was going to get some assistance from some people in Melbourne to help restore the paintings, how important was that to you?
Yeah, it was very, very important, and like I feel kind of like a hope, you know, that just people out there would never know that, you know, like think about us and feel a feeling for us, and that can help us out.
Gabrielle Nadir is the chair of the Warman Arts Centre. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN. We're discussing the handover of some important artworks that have been restored over the last couple of years to the the local community in the Kimberley, the Gidja community, the Gidja people. These artworks have been being restored after some fairly significant flooding went through the area just over 2 years ago. Now, one of the people that's been key to the restoration efforts is Marcel Scott, the curator at Melbourne University's Centre for Cultural Materials Conservation. Marcel, we've just heard from both Gabriel and Rosaline how important to the local community these artworks have been. What about in the artistic community? What's the significance of these paintings?
Well, the artistic community really recognised that the artists who established the Warman Art Centre were at the forefront of the contemporary art movement, Aboriginal art movement. And the very, very significant names of those deceased artists that, as Gabriel and Rosaline mentioned. And those deceased artists' works on the commercial market go for, very, very significant amounts of money. So there's that aspect of it.
When you say significant, we're talking tens of thousands, sometimes even the hundreds of thousands.
Well, we're sometimes talking way more than that.
So highly sought
after. We're talking seven figures. In the case of some of the most important works of those most important artists. And one of the things that really concerned us, and I suppose one of the reasons why the artists were keen for us at Melbourne University to be involved, is that people here, overseas, people hear that the art centre's been destroyed and the artworks have been lost. It is an opportunity for people to act inappropriately. That's putting it nicely. And there's a real risk to the reputation and to the record of these artists if people start to, say they found a painting down the creek bed or something and it enters the art movement.
Oh, okay. So if there's uncertainty about what's happened to a certain piece of artwork, there's more opportunity for forgeries.
Well, that's exactly right. That's what happens. People see an opportunity. I mean, I'm not saying that it's happened, but certainly that is a fear that we have and was a driving force for one of the reasons for us to be involved. I mean, obviously, the key reason is the significance of these works, and that was central to our role, to conserve the works, restore them, and return them to the community. But in the back of our mind, and one of the other aspects of it is that you don't want anything inappropriate. You don't want an opportunity for that. So one of the central parts of our program was to document the works, and my colleague Linda Nordenman Parker was responsible for that. We produced a very accurate listing. We were able to confirm exactly the number of works that were salvaged and returned those to the community. So we've documented them as well as restored them to assure that reputation within the market.
So there's three, if I put it really basically, there's three pretty good reasons to have salvaged this artwork. There's the monetary value, there's the cultural importance, and there's also maintaining the integrity of some world-renowned artists from this part of Australia. What sort of state were the artworks in when you took hold of them to try to repair them?
Well, they had really just been plucked from the floodwaters, and Rosaline mentioned her role in that, and then they were airlifted by Argyle into Kununurra.
This is Argyle Diamonds. They even helped out.
They did. They made their choppers available and went into the community, and Rosaline and her colleagues assisted to load the paintings. More than 300 paintings taken into the Argyle offices, and that's where I arrived on the scene. Linda Norman Parker and I arrived from Melbourne into the Kununurra offices and started the documentation and the conservation program there. Well, they were wet and they were mouldy and they were muddy, and some of them, many of them were all of those things. Some of them with grass and leaves and twigs sticking out of them. And, some of that took us to the sort of frontier of our conservation knowledge. We had to really hold our nerve with some of those things.
Yeah. I understand in a Western sense, if we think of things in a Western sense, that part of the preparation of some of these paintings was what we might think of as quite strange or quirky. They've been used things like kangaroo blood and tree sap was used in their preparation, but that might have actually helped protect them from the water. Can you explain what was involved there?
Well, one of the really wonderful things about these artworks is that they are prepared, painted with the natural ochres of this land, and the binder, what binds those pigments together, is natural saps. And as a conservator, I think to myself, well, those natural ochres that are covered in mud, it's going to be very, very hard to differentiate them. But the artists knew better than that, and as it turns out, the paint surfaces have been very, very robust, and we have been able to clean them, you know, much better than I anticipated.
Much to your relief, I guess.
Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah. And you know, the art centre manager at the time said to me that the Gidja people are resilient and strong people, and so are these stories. And I just really have found that out during the process, and it's caused us to really want to work much more closely with the artists here to better understand their knowledge of the materials and the preparation of them.
So you've learned a lot in the process, and it sounds like it's had quite an impact on you as well. Must have had a huge sense of responsibility during this project.
Well, that's very true, and probably that's the emotional side of it. I mean, you know, as a professional, you know that the works that you're working on are very, you know, are significant to society, to the owners. But the level of trust that has been bestowed on us at the centre from the Gidja artists here, from the Art Centre, has been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And to trust us at that time, where the community had been destroyed, where the infrastructure had been destroyed, and that really the paintings being their connection back to their community. Mm. And I realised, you know, there in those early days in Kununurra, how important the works were when really very senior artists came into the offices there to look at the paintings. And when I think that they had family responsibilities, they had frightened children at home who'd been through this catastrophe. When I realised, you know, that other jobs to do, but when they came in to look at the paintings, I realised there and then that these were very, very significant works. Mm.
I wonder if there's an awful lot of interest in this within the artistic community broadly as well, given that Gidja artists have gained quite a bit of attention just in recent weeks with some work in Paris.
Well, isn't that amazing? And that's one of the reasons that we're here in Warman at the moment, certainly to celebrate Lina's triumph, really, in Paris.
This is the artwork that was that was on the roof of the museum in Paris to be viewed from the Eiffel Tower, amongst other things.
That's right, and the celebration was there, and Rosaline, who spoke earlier, was with Lina and at that opening. So we're celebrating that. Of course, everyone's excited to welcome Lina back. Mm. And there'll be a big celebration about that tonight. But yeah.
And there's also the celebration and the ceremony to hand over the artwork that's been repaired and restored. Are you incredibly excited about that? What are you expecting?
Well, the chairman gave me some very, very inspirational words recently about those, and I'll keep them very close. But actually, we don't take any pride in this, in the return of it. We're just very grateful to have been part of it. And, I'm delighted that the works are now back in their rightful place. And we're just actually unpacking them now.
Marcel Scott, curator at Melbourne University's Centre for Cultural Materials Conservation. You also heard earlier from Gabriel Nadir, the chair of the Warman Arts Centre, and local artist and Gidja woman Rosaline Park. Just before we wrap things up for the week, a pointer to what's coming up next week on Bush Telegraph. We've heard a lot about the downturn in food manufacturing in Australia, but raises the question, what happens to towns and communities months and even years down the track? So next week we'll journey from Childers in Queensland to Smithton in northwest Tasmania to find out. We'll be meeting local business owners, farmers and even some former factory workers.
While we were there and we were working, we celebrated each little like footstep. Like when the peas finished, we had a bit of a celebration, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right.
And when the beans finished, we had another bit of a celebration the day they fished. Like it was both sad and happy. When I go to bed for night, I often look out at McCain's because we look straight down over the McCain factory, and I think,
suckers,
boy, I could be going down there tonight, starting at 11, finishing at 7, and I'm here. Yeah,
watching the steam rise up now.
But I say all the time, I don't miss the factory at all, but I miss the people.
Yeah,
right.
I reminisce
every now and again and think, oh, it'd be nice to catch up with a lot of them again.
Yeah, that's right.
That's former McCain workers that are still living in Smithton in Tasmania despite the factory's closure, which was 4 years ago. Now, join us next week on Bush Telly for that special report. Also, if you're online, the Wilber 101 poll is still open till this afternoon. It's on the RN Facebook page. You just need to scroll down a little bit if you want to have your say on the vaccination question this week, or you can go to the RN Bush Telly page. On the right-hand side, there's a feature there following Wilber's progress throughout the year, so find that online anytime you like. That is the program for today and for the week. A big thank you to the team this week. Executive producer Claire Arthurs, producers Kathy Pryor, Greg Miller, Belinda Tromp and Kieran McLennan, and technical production this week from Melissa May, Gary Heverlay and Tim Simons. Judy Kennedy will join you Monday. I'll see you a little later next week. Have a good weekend. You're on RN.
Hi, Richard Ady here. If you remember George Orwell's 1984, you'll remember the telescreens. Part television for delivering party propaganda and part surveillance device. And I mention them because on the media report, we talk about surveillance, how for reporters, it's often difficult to report upon. And we talk about the connected TV. This doesn't have to be a high-end set. It can be a normal telly that's plugged into the internet. And here's the thing, it can watch you while you watch it. The media report. Download it from the Radio National website.